This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Early last Thursday morning, Congressman Patrick Kennedy crashed his green Ford Mustang into a barricade on Capitol Hill. First, he blamed the accident on some medications that he'd taken, but later announced that he would fly to the Mayo Clinic for treatment of chronic depression and drug addiction. Congressman Kennedy is just the latest celebrity to discuss struggles with mental illness, but most of us don't have the same resources and the same options and may not know where to turn for help. May is Mental Health Month. Today we'll look at how adults can find the best mental health care. We'll talk with a clinical psychologist and a practicing family physician about different approaches. We'll try to demystify the differences among health care providers and types of therapy and try to answer your questions about what questions to ask. If you've dealt with a mental illness, how did you find help? What kind of treatment did you try? Did it work? Join the conversation. But first, a disclaimer. We cannot diagnose individual problems on the radio or prescribe treatments. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is talk@npr.org. Later on in the program, potable water and politics in New Orleans' Lower Ninth Ward and your letters. But first, how to find the best mental health care. Our first guest learned the hard way. Andrew Solomon is the author of The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression, which has won the National Book Award. He's also a regular contributor to The New Yorker magazine and joins us now from our bureau in New York City. Nice to have you back on the program.
What a pleasure to be here.
When did you first experience serious depression, and when did you first recognize it as depression?
I'd had some minor episodes, which I didn't recognize when I was younger. But my first serious episode came in 1994, when I was 31 years old, at a period after I'd gone through some rather difficult things after the death of my mother and when I was publishing a novel and so on. And it took me a long time to recognize it, and the delay in recognizing it led to its escalating in quite a terrifying way.
When you did recognize it, what did you do about it?
When I did finally recognize it, which was when I was finally completely beaten down and totally paralyzed and unable to get out of bed and unable to function, I went to see a psychiatrist about it, and I ultimately went on medication. But I should say that as the depression was building and as it was developing, I was seeing a psychoanalyst who failed to recognize it or to identify it, and who told me it was very courageous to keep fighting on without drugs, and that because of that bad advice, the depression escalated and was a great deal worse than it would have otherwise needed to be.
And that was just a medical error. I mean, he didn't recognize it either.
Right. But those medical errors, I think, really constitute a form of malpractice, and they're terrifyingly frequent. Since writing this book, I've talked to lots of people who, for whatever reason, are resistant to the idea of seeking help and therefore don't get any. And I've talked to people who've had good help, but also to a huge number of people who've gone to see doctors and have not had the help that they really need.
And doesn't that play into the whole stigma idea that, hey, you can fight this on yourself. You don't really want to even admit that it's there.
Yes, people have the idea that they should be able to control depression. There is this huge stigma associated with it. I think it's very difficult to bear the anguish of being depressed, even if everyone around you is being as supportive as possible. It makes it a lot more difficult if you're trying to keep it a big secret. And the idea that you should be able to pull yourself through it is not only wrong, but impossible.
And obviously we're getting some music playing into the... there, it's gone away. I don't know whether
right.
That was in the New York Bureau or here in Studio 3A, but we put it down and we'll come back.
Excellent.
I promise
that. I wasn't sure if it was a hint. I thought I was going off topic.
Well, let me put it this way. I'm just glad both of us were hearing it. Looking back, what would you have done differently?
The first thing I would say is that people often say, I just really want to brave this out on my own, and I don't want to take medication. But the fact of the matter is that untreated depression tends to escalate, it tends to get worse, and that while the medications cause temporary changes in your brain, which are reversed if you stop taking the medications, untreated depression ultimately causes lesions in the hippocampus and really causes damage, physical damage to the brain. And so people should recognize the seriousness of the enterprise. I think I should have sought help much sooner. I think I should have gone on medication much sooner. I think I should have been working with a therapist. And I don't think medication is the only answer. It is the most efficient and the most proven. But I think the combination of medication education in psychotherapy was the right thing for me, and I wish I'd got into it sooner.
Despite the fact that at least one psychotherapist gave you the bad advice.
Yes. But one of the things that I wanted to achieve in writing The Noonday Demon was to allow people to be informed enough so that they would understand what depression is, know when they were settling into one, and have a sense of what they should expect and should be able to demand from people who are treating them.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things we want to get to. I mean, what questions do you think would be the right ones to ask?
I think, in the first place, you have to have someone who you feel, when you interact with that person, is listening to you and understands you. And that if you meet someone who you feel doesn't get it, that should be a sign to you to go find somebody else right away. It's stressful looking for a therapist, especially when you're feeling depressed, but you really need someone who connects. Ideally, you should have someone who can look at the extent to which the depression has been triggered by external causes, who will ask you questions about the trajectory of the depression, because I often say to people when they say, well, I'm feeling really terrible, but I'm not sure if I'm just upset or if I'm depressed, and I say, okay, there was an event a month ago. If you're feeling a little better than you were feeling a month ago, even if you're feeling horrible, you're probably headed in the right direction. If you're feeling worse than you were a month ago, you're on a downward trajectory, and that's very dangerous, and you're probably heading into a serious depression. So you need someone who's going to take a history from you in a coherent way and try to follow the emotional issues behind you. And then I think you want someone who will lay out a lot of options, who will say, look, these are the different medications. This is how they work. This is one that I think might work for you. This is the kind of talk therapy I can do. Mm-hmm. These are the effects it might have. If you wanted to work with someone else, here are the other things you could pursue. Someone who will sort of paint a set of options rather than someone who will kind of bossily say to you, oh, well, what you have to do is this, and right. Sort of shove you into doing something without allowing you to understand what it is.
Somebody who approaches it, obviously medically, but at the same time as a service provider, in the same way of providing you an estimate. This is how we're going to go about it. Here are your other options, but I recommend this.
And I think it's always, always worth seeing at least two people so that you can have a little bit of a different perspective from somebody else. And then you can think, oh, that's so strange. This one person said these things and this other person said, and sometimes that'll send you to a third person. If they both say the same thing, maybe that indicates that they're sort of onto something, but you won't have any perspective if you go to only one doctor.
And how do you find these doctors? From your friends? From the phone book? What?
You can find them. Actually, people do find them in both of those ways. The best thing to do, however, is to get in touch with a teaching hospital, whatever the best hospital in your area is, and ask for advice from their department of psychiatry and see if they can give you an initial interview. The best people in the field tend to cluster around big hospitals. So if you live anywhere near a big hospital, it's worth starting at a big hospital, and then they may be able at the hospital to refer you on to somebody else.
And one final question. Many people have family members, loved ones, dear friends who are suffering serious problems from depression and are reluctant to look for work. Is there any advice you can give them to how to nudge people towards getting help for themselves?
The question of what to do when someone you love is depressed is a big and a complicated one. Frequently, people who are depressed say, just leave me alone, because they find all human interaction incredibly stressful. But actually, depression is a disease of loneliness. And if you leave people alone, the depression is only going to get worse. Sometimes they can't bear to have a lot of social interaction with you, but you should make it known always that you're present and that you're in the next room. And in terms of getting them to seek help, I think it's important to medicalize it, to say, look, this is a dysfunction that has been traced as a chemical set of processes in the brain, and it's a disease like any other disease. To say it's incredibly frequent. By the year 2010, it's predicted to be the leading cause of disability worldwide. To say, if you go for help and it's helpful, you'll be glad you went. If you go and see someone and you decide after a few weeks that it's not helpful and that you're really getting better on your own, then you don't have to stick with it. It's not a life sentence. And just to say to them, depression is dangerous. Lots of people die through suicide because they've had depression. Lots of other people lose many, many useful life years. It's a terrible, serious illness, and it needs to be taken seriously. And you need to treat it, because otherwise it will destroy your life and the lives of those around you.
Andrew Solomon, thank you very much for coming in. We appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Andrew Solomon's book is The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. He joined us today from our bureau in New York. There is a lot of confusion over mental health care and the many different therapies and therapists out there. To help us explain the differences among healthcare providers and the types of therapy they practice, we're joined here in Studio 3A by Raymond Kroll, a clinical psychologist and vice president of the National Mental Health Association. And it's very good of you to be with us as well.
Thank you. Happy to be here today.
And just going back from some of Andrew Solomon's, what's the estimate of how many Americans suffer from depression?
Oh, God, it's anywhere from 1 in 10 to 1 in 20. Over the lifespan.
And is that the most common problem, the mental problem?
It's one of the most common mental problems that occurs to people. There are other things, anxiety, post-traumatic stress, panic attacks, et cetera, but depression is a very common problem in the population. Mm-hmm.
Now, who offers mental health services, and what are the differences among them?
Well, there are, in terms of professionals that do mental health services, there are a couple of different groups, fairly common professions that offer it. Psychiatrists, who are medical doctors who've been trained to diagnose and treat and also to prescribe medication. Psychologists are also very common in the world, who do usually have an advanced degree, a master's degree, or a PhD from a university, and along with a couple of years of supervision, who do psychotherapy, evaluation, and assessment. And clinical social workers are also. Now, I have to tell you that my other colleagues would be very angry if I didn't talk about licensed professional counselors or mental health counselors mm-hmm. or nurse psychotherapists, marriage counselors, et cetera, and pastoral counselors who also may do provide mental health services or psychotherapy. The key is licensed practitioners in the state or where near where you live.
And again, that question that we talked to Andrew Solomon about, where do you begin?
It's a complicated process. It's as much art as it is science. But I think there are a couple of things. It's going to require some research and some effort on the part of a person who wants to find a therapist. I think there are a couple of things. You have to begin by asking yourself a couple of questions. What do you want out of a therapist? What are your issues? Is it for a child? Is it for yourself? Is it about depression or anxiety? So you get some sense of what kind of therapist you're looking for. I think the second issue is, what are your preferences? Do you want someone who's male or female, who are culturally or linguistically similar or dissimilar to yourself? And then lastly, access issues. How do you get to to the person? Can you get to them easily and in a timely fashion?
We're going to have more on this. And, of course, your calls. Please join us, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It is the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. More than a quarter of American adults face some sort of diagnosable mental health issue in any given year. But navigating the health system can be difficult. Today, we're talking about how adults can find the best mental health care, where to go, what to ask, who to see. Our guest is Dr. Raymond Kroll, a clinical psychologist and vice president of the National Mental Health Association. If you'd like to join us, give us the benefit of your experience, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's begin with John L. John L. calling from Indiana.
Hi. I have several things I want to say. I just want to reiterate what your first guest said about how you can lose so many life years if you don't deal with this. But I want to, my main point that I want to make to people is, it took me several years of actively working on this, sometimes just therapy, sometimes therapy and medication. Sometimes I would feel like I was doing well and would say, I don't need the medication anymore, and then you get back to the back. But I guess my main point is that I want to say that it may take several different medications until you find the one that works for you. Just because Prozac works for your girlfriend doesn't mean it's going to work for you. And it may be a combination of more than one medication that will work for you. And it's time-consuming because of the amount of time it takes to build up in your system and the amount of time you have to let it go down before you can try something new. But I just want people to stick with it, because mm-hmm. if you find the right combination, it's just a miracle.
I can hear the emotion in your voice, John L. And you say it took many years and different therapists of different types?
Yes. I moved through different therapists kind of as I moved through discovering different things. And you know, the first therapist helped me with to discover some things about myself, and then I found that there was another area that was maybe more of a problem and a different therapist was more helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I did go through the moving of one of my therapists moved away. My psychiatrist died. Thankfully, I didn't have abandonment issues. But
how could he do that to you?
But and I do work both with a therapist and a psychiatrist. And I don't want to denigrate family doctors, but there are so many new drugs all the time and so many nuances of these drugs that if you can afford to and if you can find a good one, I think if you're going to go with medication, working with a psychiatrist really is very beneficial. You may find the family practitioner here and there who really has an interest in it, but for me, I found that, you know, it just was so much quicker to get to the right things working with a psychiatrist.
Hmm. Raymond Kroll, Janelle's experience is not unusual, I don't think.
It is not unusual. And in fact, I want to thank her for bringing home a very important point that when you're faced with a depression, first medication may not always work, and that as time goes on, you need to stay with it and give that medication or other medications or combinations a chance to see which one works best for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a short process. It may take many years or time before you begin to really get better.
And maybe the right medication, but the wrong dosage, too.
Maybe the right medication, but the wrong dosage. So there are a lot of variables at play, despite how good the science is around the medication. And similarly, the first therapist may not be the one you stay with forever. You may need to change therapist as issues change, and, mm-hmm. and that's important to keep in mind as well.
Janelle, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck to you.
Thank you. Can I make one more point?
Sure.
People think of depression as, I'm so sad, I'm crying, I can't do anything, but for me personally, and I see this now as on the other side of getting things together, anger and irritability were one of my big symptoms. And I can look back at my teen years and see that it was manifesting itself then. And so I always say to people, you know, if all the other people in the world really irritate you, maybe you're the one that has the problem. And sometimes it's not being sad. Sometimes it's just being constantly in an uproar that also can be depression.
Okay, thanks very much.
Yes.
Bye-bye. Let's go to George, and George is with us on the phone from Rockford, Illinois.
Yes, and thank you for having me.
Sure.
Well, I suffer from depression, and I myself went through three separate counselors, three different forms of medication, and probably about 2.5 years of, you know, weekly meetings, and, you know, it took some time to find the right person to talk to, and when I did, we were able to diagnose my major problems, which I had a codependency issue, which is, you know, the need to always feel needed.
Mm-hmm.
And I am now, I haven't been to a counselor in probably about 4 years now. I'm still on medication, and I still talk to my family doctor on a regular basis about it, and I'm living a healthy and productive life.
Well,
and
that's great to hear, George, but before you found help, how did you find out which doctor, which approach worked for you?
Trial and error. I went out there, and I asked people that I knew, you know, had depression or something, who do you talk to? Who mm-hmm. do you see? And I went and I tried them, and I said, no, this isn't the right person for me. This person, you know, may be great for somebody else, but it's not going to work for me. And I went on and I tried somebody else, and luckily, one day I thumbed through the newspaper or the phone book, and I said, okay, I'm going to call this person. And I went and saw that person, and I hit it off with them, and I felt comfortable, and we worked through a lot of my issues.
Hmm.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask Raymond Kroll. I mean, again, it's that question of how do you find the right person? And there are all these different kinds of therapies that for a layperson, a doctor can lay them out for me, and he might as well be speaking Greek. I don't know, really know which would be best adapted for me.
That's right. It's hard to tell sometimes. I think in terms of finding someone, the caller, George's comment is he's right on in terms of sometimes it's just serendipity. You stumble across the right clinician or the right therapist at time, but there are other ways you can go about doing that. Hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about that. One of the things that you need to always ask a therapist is what is their area of specialty, what mm-hmm. is their focus, what is their approach to treatment of depression, to at least least begin to get a sense of whether or not it feels right for you or it fits how you're thinking about what's going on in your life. It's a give and take process, and you have to explore, be willing to, and the therapist has to be willing to let you explore that with them. Mm-hmm.
And George, when did you know it was time to stop?
We stepped our meetings back to talk, you know, to like every other week and stuff like that. And it was kind of a mutual thing between me and my counselor. I said, you know, I think I'm on the right path. And she told me, she said, I'm here whenever you need me.
Hmm.
And that was, you know, the point where I said, okay, there's a point that you have to do this yourself. And once you've been given all the tools, you go. And one thing I do want to say is, I have a younger sister who suffers from the same kind of depression that I did. And the hardest part about someone suffering from depression is you can give them all the tools that they want or that they would ever need, and if they're not ready to use them, it won't change anything. And that's the hardest part in dealing with someone who has depression is if they're not willing to take those major steps and buckle down and do the things that they need to do to change, nothing in their life will change. And I think that's a problem that a lot of people have.
George, thanks very much.
Thank you.
As some of our callers have suggested, you can try the phone book. You can talk to your friends. Another idea might be to talk to your family doctor. Joining us now is Dr. Alan Dietrich, a practicing primary care physician and co-director of the MacArthur Foundation Initiative on Depression and Primary Care at the Dartmouth Medical School. He's with us now from the Dartmouth studio in Hanover, New Hampshire. Nice to have you on the program today. Hello, Dr. Dietrich. Well, apparently we're having some difficulties getting the line up from Dartmouth, so we'll try that later and bring him back. In the meantime, we'll get another caller on the line, and this is Kate. Kate's with us from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have bipolar disorder and was diagnosed in my early 20s and have, you know, gone through a number of... Yeah, and I've gone through a number of... psychiatrist and psychologist in my day, so I'm pretty horrific. And about 10 years ago...
I'm sorry? What's going...
Hello?
Yes, what's going on?
I think that your doctor is on the line.
Ah, okay. Let's see if we can sort that out. And why don't you go ahead, Kate, and we'll take him out until we're ready to bring him back in.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I was just saying that I was diagnosed with bipolar in my early 20s. I'm now in my late 40s. And about 15 years ago, I had a really severe episode of depression, and I had to switch psychiatrists right about at the same time. And so I actually went out and interviewed psychiatrists. I spoke to my former doctor who was cutting his clinical practice back. I talked to friends and support groups. I looked in the phone book. I called the Michigan Psychiatric Society. I lived in Michigan at the time. And I set up appointments to interview the doctors. And I said, you know, look, I'll pay you for the visit, but I have questions about, you know, your amount of expertise in bipolar disorder,
mm-hmm.
you know, what percentage of your clientele is in that, you know, how many, you know, continuing medical education credits do you focus on this? Do you do any research? And I called about 10 different doctors, and 5 of them refused to even talk to me. And
really? They just refused?
Yeah, because they just thought it was offensive. And it's like I said, well, I do research before I buy a car. You know, this is my brain.
Huh.
And then of the 5 that I spoke with, 3 of them cut it short after about 10 minutes, you know, because they just weren't used to people asking them. And then the last one actually has been my doctor now for, you know, about 12, 13 years. And, you know, he at first, and then some of the other people were saying, you know, you have to be able to really communicate. And I felt like he wasn't listening to me. And it's so horrible to search for a doctor because you have to tell your story. And it's so awful that I didn't want to go through it again. So I made up my mind for my next appointment. I was going to tell him that I felt like he wasn't listening to me. And I said, before you say anything, I just need to say something. And I told him this. And he goes, oh, I'm so sorry, Kate. I didn't realize that. And he, like, practically was a tape recorder of what I talked about the last 3 sessions. He says, please don't. Don't think that, you know, I'm listening. And he's been so great. I mean, he talks about the medications, he talks about the side effects, he's patronizing. Even though I moved to New Mexico, I still see him. When I was in between jobs a few years ago, he gave me samples of my meds because I didn't have the $800 a month without prescription coverage. You know, I mean, he's fantastic, and I have my life back. But it took so much. And I, you know, the first doctor I tried to see back when I was in college and had trouble, and I figured out what it was, and I even suggested that I had this, and the doctor says, well, no, you're trying too hard to be a man, and if you dropped out of engineering school and got married and had babies, you'd be fine. So, you know, you can really go the gamut.
Well, other than people who are Pleistocene-trained...
kind of what I thought, but I was pretty sick at the time. It's funny in retrospect, but it wasn't then.
Raymond Kroll, as Kate was talking about her efforts to interview doctors about, you were nodding your head, but then, you know, so many of them said, this is offensive.
Pleistocene trained is a good phrase, I think. I'm going to use that, I think. The truth of the matter is that you'll run the gamut, and Kate is what I would advocate for everybody. She's a smart consumer. She has questions. She knows what she needs. She's got a sense about how she wants a person to treat her and interact with her. And a good physician, a caring and sensitive physician will stop and will listen and will take the time to answer the questions and wants, in fact, a partner in the treatment process.
Kate, thanks very much for the advice. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We're talking about how to get the best mental health care. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I think we've managed to relocate Dr. Alan Dietrich, who's up at the Dartmouth Studio in Hanover, New Hampshire, a practicing primary care physician and professor of community and family medicine at Dartmouth School of Medicine. Good to have you with us today.
Hi, Neil.
Good. Now, there you are, finally. Now, why do you advocate asking your family doctor as sort of a gateway?
Well, I wouldn't use the term a gateway so much as a doorway for patients needing mental health services. Primary care physicians today, family physicians, general internists, general pediatricians, are quite well trained for assisting people to make early decisions about whether they have a mm-hmm. mental health problem, beginning to help them make choices about how it should be pursued, and if necessary, to facilitate referrals. The situation that Andrew described, having to call up a medical center, Department of Psychiatry, and sort your way through that, seems like a formidable thing to have to work your way through. And most primary care providers are very well prepared to help patients decide if they have a mental health disorder that needs specific treatment mm-hmm. and to help them get the treatment they need.
So are primary care doctors, internists, for example, trained to treat mental health?
Yes, they are. They're trained to treat the most common mental health disorders that show up in a primary care practice. So, for example, in family medicine residency training, general internal medicine training, general pediatric training, people do rotations. They also have instruction from experts as they do their training in their own training practices to learn about diagnosis, to learn about how to help patients get the care they need.
Mm-hmm. One of our callers said earlier that there have been so many developments with various kinds of drugs and various kinds of studies that primary care physicians can't possibly keep up with it.
Well, there are a lot of drugs all the time, I think a primary care physician may actually be in a position to have a protective role. When I was in training, one of the things I learned was to not be the first doctor on my block to prescribe a new medication. And there are tried and true medications that have been around for 10 years or more that primary care physicians are well qualified to prescribe. But I'm not shy about referring a patient with a cardiac problem to a cardiologist or a pulmonary problem to a pulmonologist. And so, too, if I need help with mental health, whether it's medication, I'm happy to send them to a psychiatrist. If it's for counseling, I'm happy to send them to any of the other mental health specialists that were listed earlier.
Mm-hmm. Just along those lines, should a patient be a little bit suspicious, in fact, if their primary care physician says, I can help you. We don't need a referral, or at least not at this point.
Well, I think the primary care physician is in a good position to help with diagnosis. If the patient's not satisfied with what the primary care provider is doing, or if the provider's not listening, patient might want to consider finding someone else for their primary care.
Yet, as you know, a lot of patients feel intimidated by their doctors. I mean, afraid to ask even basic consumer questions some of the time.
But it's less intimidating, I think, to talk to a primary care physician whom you know over time and to raise a question about whether a mental health disorder might be involved than it is to go to an entirely new provider, perhaps have to park your car in front of your office and have to face the stigma And many primary care offices now have co-located mental health personnel, either on a all-the-time basis or a rotating basis. So it's also in many offices possible to get mental health specialty services right in the primary care office.
All right. Stay with us, if you would. We're going to take a short break, and we'll continue both with you, Dr. Dietrich, and with Raymond Kroll, who is the Vice President of the National Mental Health Association, with us here in Washington. And, of course, we'll take more of your calls on this issue. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. And we'll also be talking about some good news, finally, for residents of New Orleans' Lower Ninth Ward. Some may be able to move home in the near future. And it's Tuesday. We'll read your letters. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Our guests are Raymond Kroll, a clinical psychologist and vice president of the National Mental Health Association, who's with us here in Studio 3A, and Dr. Alan Dietrich, a practicing primary care physician and co-director of the MacArthur Foundation's Initiative on Depression and Primary Care at the Dartmouth Medical School. He's with us from Dartmouth Studio in Hanover, New Hampshire. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Bob.
And yeah, hi.
Bob's calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, my brother suffers from depression, and it's a family problem that's been happening for the last 15 years or so. And it's not always the person with the problem that has to find the care for the person, you know. It's sometimes the family members that have to find the care for these people with the problems.
And how do you
notice one thing, that you'll get a different opinion from every doctor, and a lot of these doctors are quick to the pharmaceuticals that probably solve with a pill. Did you have your purple pill today? And family members put a lot of faith in the medication. And in my case, we saw a lot of bad side effects from the medication, like stammers, stuttering, stuff like that, where the problem became even more evident through the medication. And in our case, after several doctors, he was weaned off of medication and was more into a group thing. My point is, mental health is a big problem in the country, and we're so quick to find answers through doctors, and we put faith in these pharmaceuticals, and sometimes they're not the answer.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I think there's a lot of pressure to push pharmaceuticals. And finding a doctor isn't always on the patient. It's on the part of the family also, the support, because we're the ones that recognize there's a problem there. And
well, let's get a response from Raymond Kroll. Obviously, every case is different. Every patient is different. But there does seem to be a sort of sociological push to go to the pharmacy.
Well, the science around medications has blossomed in the last decade, and so has the need or the marketing of medications. And there may be a tendency or temptation to rush to medications, but we want to make sure that there's a proper assessment and diagnosis that's done, and that's done in a timely way, but also takes the time to consider a variety of factors that may contribute to depression or may sustain a depression.
Mm-hmm.
So medication is something that works and does and has been demonstrated to work. Medication in concert with some forms of therapy has also been demonstrated to be highly effective. And so it's oftentimes important not just to stop with the primary care physician or the psychiatrist you see, but also to think mm-hmm. about what kinds of therapy you need over time. And if the medication isn't working, then that's something that has to be discussed quickly with the prescribing physician so that they can make changes and adjustments in it.
And Bob, how's your brother doing?
He's doing well. Again, he's been weaned off these psychotropic drugs that they use for, and he's become better. He does a group therapy type thing, one-on-one with a therapist. And sometimes, I guess, I can't, you know, every person, like you said, is different. But sometimes it's just a matter of talking to somebody
mm-hmm.
And getting to the core of the problem, whereas everybody's so quick to scientize everything that it's, you know, we can look at it under a microscope.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always the answer through pharmacology or that. And again, like I said, choosing doctors, which the topic is, a lot falls onto the family members.
Let me ask Dr. Dietrich about that. And are you approached sometimes by family members on behalf of their relatives?
Indeed, and it's admirable what Bob talks about having to do to help his family member. I think that also the issue of patient preference enters into the choice of therapies, and most primary care physicians, I'm sure most mental health professionals, psychiatrists, might assess with the patient what their choice was about embarking on treatment. And sometimes it takes a few tries. Sometimes patients will prefer medication because it doesn't involve weekly visits. It doesn't involve necessarily pre-approval with an insurance company. But it is a matter of staying with it, and families need to be very supportive of the people that are suffering.
Now, Bob mentioned something interesting, and that was time. Some of us, especially if you're in an HMO or something like that, you feel rushed describing your rotator cuff problems, much less your mental health.
For sure. The primary care visits are typically oriented on the order of 15 or 20 minutes, but doctors can schedule longer visits and follow-up. I myself might recognize a patient who I'm suspicious has a mental health disorder that needs further investigation, and I will schedule him to come back at a time that I can go into it more thoroughly.
Let's see if we get one last call in, and this is Lawrence. Lawrence from Ithaca, New York.
Hello, Neil. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate your style of being so polite and yet moving the discussion right along. So in that spirit, I'll try to be brief. I think the answer to your question you asked earlier, which was, how do you get started? Where do you go? It depends on several things. First of all, understanding the roles of your healthcare providers. Secondly, understanding that medication in the body changes, becomes acclimated, and at times you have to change your medication. And number three, figuring out what your insurance is going to cover. Now, starting out with your providers, it took me a long time to realize that psychiatrists are not there to necessarily give you back talk when you tell them what's bothering you. I look at them as I do my primary care physicians with the utmost respect, but as a mechanic, if you will, of the mind. You take your car to a mechanic and you say, you know, it's making this funny sound. And the mechanic says, oh, okay, well, does it make it when it goes up the hill or down? Well, when it goes up. And that way he can analyze, you know, your carburetor or whatever's wrong with a particular thing. I guess that's called being clinical about the situation. So that's the psychiatrist's job, is to kind of analyze what issues you have. Are you bipolar? Are you depressed? What are the issues? And from there, he can look at medication that will work to help you. Once you've done that, you can then, and this is what worked for me, is see a psychologist whose job is to talk back and forth with you, to have a discussion with you, to help you frame your issues in a way that you maybe didn't do before, in a way you haven't looked at before.
And Lawrence, I'm afraid we are running out of time. I'm just going to ask the final
thing is, what's your insurance company going to pay for?
That's another issue for another day. But Raymond Kroll, part of that psychologist endorsement, seemed like you were nodding along.
Absolutely. I think while the roles may not be quite that clear-cut, it is important to both do the psychiatric diagnosis and assessment and maybe medication, but also the combination of a variety of different kinds of talk therapies that are absolutely effective in creating change and helping people get better.
Okay. Lawrence, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you, Neil, for your show.
Appreciate it. And Dr. Dietrich, thanks for taking the time to join us today. We apologize for our technical problems earlier.
My pleasure, Neil.
Alan Dietrich, a practicing primary care physician, joined us from Dartmouth Medical School studio in Hanover, New Hampshire. And Raymond Kroll, vice president of the National Mental Health Association and a clinical psychologist, was with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much.
Pleasure to be here.